So disease-free fish or any stock at all, whether you call it plants or mussels or whatever, if you stock from healthy stock, you get another doubling of yield. Now, with all these factors out here, and they're variable because they're not constant, that's why you're getting up around 1,000 times or 2,000 times more yield. So these are all factors. There's one other interesting factor. If you're going to fertilise a pond, so it's a new pond, the first thing you have to put in is an ultra-fast growing organism, typically a shrimp, because otherwise the fertiliser that you've put in can't be utilised by the fish that you've put in because the fish are too small to utilise that fertiliser. So you've got to put in something that'll grab the fertiliser and hold it in the pond and that later becomes a food for the fish. That's a real critical thing. And for this reason, you can select a whole series of tiny little fish which are adult at 2 inches or something, ultra-fast breeders, get them swarming in the pond, fertilise the pond, these little guys grow up and they're really dense in the water, and then you put in your fish and then you'll get all your nutrient back as yield. So that's another, what's that, timing and management, isn't it? But the ploy is to put something in the pond that can rapidly grab nutrient. And one of the ideal things is small freshwater shrimp, a tyre or one of those little guys that you find all through the streams. And they're very fast responders. They'll have 1,000 eggs and have a little Norplia going in two. You know, within 2 days after you've added a nutrient, they'll have grabbed an awful lot of it. And they're holding it now as shrimp. Now your fish can grow and they work their way through the shrimp. So the nutrients held as shrimp. That's a very important ploy in ponds. So when you're adding nutrient, have something ready to receive it. Now, with a grass-eating fish, that's not so difficult because you can count that within 48 hours at most a week, all your nutrient will be in vegetation. So you can plant out your pond, add nutrient, and then put a grass-feeding fish in and the fish eats the grass. So that's not so bad. It's with your perch and all these other little guys and Murray cod and that you have to have a little fish. We've got lots of them, little Australian smelt, retropinna. They breed like fury and they in high nutrient water, and there they are then as the other fish grow, there's your smelt. Paddy's good. If you put an awful lot of frogs' eggs in, wait till your first hatch, then start to add your nutrient. Basically, you're turning it into tadpoles, and then you put in your blackfish, Murray cod, perch, whatever. And all your nutrients stored there and it's static in the pond. It's not going to go out of the pond until your tadpoles hatch, then it hops away. And then it comes back next breeding season. Yeah. One of the things that you don't find dealt with in the literature very much is what is the influence of the order of size on ponds, you know. You can occasionally find Chakroff, a few others say that the ideal pond is, you know, a quarter to a half acre, which is much less an eighth to a quarter hectare pond. And that seems to be a good size to manage for a pond for harvesting, really. It's really more to do with the length of the net you can pull and any other factor. Nobody deals very much with little ponds, although there's a little bit in some of Rodale's stuff on growing in home tanks. So you want to first consider what you want to do and then consider the order of size of your pond. And really very small ponds, basically stock tanks, little things 4 to 6 feet across, the only sensible thing to grow them is high quality vegetation like taro or kangkong or Chinese water chestnuts. They really don't have a lot of other potential. So these are really good plant systems, and for that they're very worthwhile. Amortise extremely quickly. If you put high quality vegetation in, they don't have much use in fish production. And then small ponds of less than somewhere, you know, more than stock pond and less than a quarter of an acre or an eighth acre. These again are mainly ponds in which you grow vegetation with a very minor input of animals. And for that again, they're extremely useful in the home or to a small family of people. Well, we kind of worked it out on wild rice, but you need something like a quarter of this room to provide your family with grain or something. Now, that's a basic staple coming out of water or out of a little flooded pond. And you couldn't really produce very much fish out of that pond in terms of protein input. And it's probable, too, that you can't set up a decent fish system in it. And when you get up around here, you can start to produce fish or animal products. So you need that quarter acre system. And for a quarter acre, the only real commercial proposition is a very high value fish, like prawns. And I do have friends who make a living from a quarter an acre of prawns. So at that stage, which is sort of house block size, The only commercial use is very high quality product too. But larger than that, from 8 hectares up to any infinite size, you can very well, just by slightly modifying natural yields, it's a full income. Yabbies, for instance, that's a hell of a good income, 8 hectares of yabbies. So they all have different... Your choices really lie on what you're putting in the pond at its size. No. Or if you want to go real kinky, you can use... I think it's 4 hectares of eels gets you $250,000 a year, providing a little stream for the elvers to swim up. So when you get up to there, suddenly all your commercial options are open. 8 hectares and above. Now that sounds a lot. In fact, if you go around the countryside looking for good sites, there are thousands of sites where you'll get 8 hectares of water for a very, very cheap dam. So if you're looking for water places forward, there are places you'll get 1,000 hectares of water with a dam 15 feet high and 20 feet long. So at that stage, you're in a lakeside sales position. A friend of mine did that recently, and he hires out trout fishing huts at $150 a day all around his lake, and he's retired in a year. I mean, that sort of situation is very common in Australia. You can buy a lot of sheep properties in which there's one little stream meandering through a gap in the hills and close the gap up and the whole bloody property disappears underwater. In that situation, you've got you can play every possible game there is. You can have little vegetation ponds around the edges, and you can lease the yabby farm into 10 yabby farmers and sell off the trout rights to 150 trout fishermen, weekend trout fishermen, and sit back. So your options have got to be more closely defined according to the order of your pond. As I say, these little ponds are great. They're really worthwhile for high-quality vegetable product. Then, of course, these you can imagine that these larger ponds include these other guys, you know. That whatever you can do here, you can do at higher orders, just that your options open up and up. And you're still selecting very heavily here at a quarter acre, only a quarter acre of water. One of the things that is a good turnover at a quarter acre of water is a freshwater plant nursery of useful plants, and that keeps you really busy, a quarter acre of water of fresh... You don't have a freshwater plant nursery in West Australia, but that's really a hell of a good option. At that depth.
What sort of cost would you be involved in setting up a different size system initially?
Depends on where you set it up. You're setting up in this 100-foot deep kind of coarse granitic sands, then you've got a full seal cost. If you're out down south in the clays, then they're very cheap, and especially if you've got water a little bit ahead, like a spring or something, it's very cheap to set up pond series just by earth moving compared with full sealing. Except that it's worthwhile to fully seal a quarter acre pond for a plant nursery because of the high return, or for prawns because of the high return. And you can buy good tough plastic seals now the bulldozers can run over the top of and put the earth back inside them, so you can make a natural pond that is actually sealed. I don't know, I've got the material on it from the suppliers, but I can't remember its name. It's only available as of last year that you can actually run bulldozers over the membrane. Yeah, that's right. That your options here open all the way, right? But new options come in all the time, and still here you're selecting your animals closely. Once you get up to this size, and you're really in management more than selection. Some in some cases. You don't need plants to support prawns, you need chicken shit, you know. And your plants grow in the water as free motile algae and filamentous algae. But for other fish, yes, grass carp and that, you have special grassed areas that are flooded periodically where they come in and graze it, you know. So the management of each is slightly different, but a lot of things you can don't have to have plants in the water. It's good to have plants on the edge, but not necessarily in the water.
Will you be covering all the harvesting and marketing of these?
I could cover it for you. Yeah.
Sure, just
oh, well, right. Let's go back to the eel figure. There's only one book on the growing of eels by a Japanese, and it came out 2 years ago. So it's the only book on... There's two books called Eels. One's by a guy called Smith, who's on the biology of the eel. And there's another book called Eel Growing. So you're not in any confusion. There's only... if you go to a library, they'll look up eels in the zoological record. There's only one book on it. And it's on the culture of eels. And you're not worried about market, because the guy states in this book that if we could breed all the elders in the world, we would be under the market demand. We couldn't possibly... We'll never grow enough eels.
Where's this tomorrow?
For eels? Right. Well, we ship out elders from Tasmania to Holland or Europe. The Dutch run tanker fleets to pick up live eels all over the world. Eels are about 70 to 90 cents a kilogram right here, smoked. And there's an unlimited market. Try and get some smoked eel. You're very lucky to get them. There's far more market for eels than there are for eels. I just hang them up in the air and say I've got smoked eels. And look out, you know. I can eat about 75 metres of smoked eel a year, I guess.
75 metres.
Yeah. And then the really successful guys, like this guy out of Launceston with a very small trout farm. He doesn't sell any trout. He sells salmon paste. And... he makes a fortune on it, you know, these tiny little jars of salmon paste, which he processes right there from his trout. He doesn't sell trout at all, sells salmon paste. And he's... Yeah. So he produces that. Same with smoked eel, really.
Salmon
paste. Yeah. Rainbow salmon. Salmo, Sala.
What about the prawns and the other...
Prawns, usually, again, there's a huge market demand. And probably if you're producing from a quarter of an acre, my friend does, he just sells to one hotel, finish. Doesn't, can't cover any more than one pub.
And is it a continual harvest or is it just one harvest?
Well, where you grow on them, you can harvest over a long period, like you can sell over a couple of months, you know, in no hurry, or you can freeze them, or you can cook them, or you can cook them and freeze them, or you can make prawn paste. It feeds all the heads, it grinds all the heads and things and feeds them back to the prawns. Gets all those back into the pond. So market isn't very difficult depending on what you're growing. If you're growing yellow-eyed mullet, on the other hand, which is wild caught in large quantities, and if you're not processing it, then you're in trouble because you're competing with a commonly wild caught fish, what you call herring. Right, there's a lot of herring in the sea. The only people making money out of herring are the New Zealanders, and they're just doing a very nice smoked herring out of yellow-eyed mullet. And they're making a packet out of it. So you have to go to your processing stage. I think sometimes you have to go to a processing stage. Depends on the remoteness of your location. If you find a good spring up in the central desert and growing prawns there, then you've got to freeze or maybe even process. You're not going to get them to market in a fresh state. So it's all a matter of what you investigate, but you're safe in eels and you're safe in prawns so far. Well, how long you'll be safe in prawns is in some doubt as the cane farmers start to turn their cane fields over into giant prawn farms. Avocados have come down to 20 cents an avocado all over the north now. They'll get down to 10 cents where they ought to be.
$2 in this
stuff. Yeah, I know, but you're far enough away not to know you can buy them for 20 cents up there. See?
Oh, no, they're about 40 cents in South Australia.
Yeah. So, but eels, you're dead safe, see, because there never will be enough eels. Never will be.
How fast are eels not?
They're very slow growing. Like, you sell them out at about 4 years, right? Well, they don't multiply on land anyhow, they multiply in the sea. No one can breed them. So one of the big sales is elvers. Ireland makes a fortune out of elvers. She's the only country that traps most of her elvers. No, well, you want to be near a little creek with eels in it. And millions of them run up. Like a couple of months ago at home, looked as though the water was alive. It was just shimmering with elvers. Well, only a tiny fraction of those survive unless you transfer them into rearing ponds. Everything eats elvers. They're all that long when they come in. But it's those that we ship out a lot of. You've really got to...
Well, then where's your success then? How do you breed your eels if you can't breed?
You don't breed eels, you rear eels.
Oh, you rear eels.
You rear eels. Any damn thing you like. You can grow the food in the ponds for them. You know, they love shrimp. Or you can feed them on any sort of wastes, like slaughterhouse wastes, minced up, frozen, just float a little iceberg of minced livers out, and as it melts, the eels get it. Then you can have that stored for you at a slaughterhouse, minced waste, in their freezer, and just go and get your iceberg. Conversion rates aren't high, but the more fish you can grow, the better. We'll go into that in a minute, I think. The more food you can produce for your eels, the better. Right, so now flow. So you've got choices of isolating ponds or of putting ponds in series so that the same flow serves each pond sequentially, or of putting them in parallel. So you use your flow, but that each pond has an individually controlled inlet and outlet, and each of them has different advantages. Isolate ponds are quite good because if you're worried about disease or if you are using the same animal all the time, like eels, it's typical that you put an eighth acre, a half acre pond that's year one, year two, and these are your rearing ponds. That's typical eel setup. You don't want any flow through because if these little guys go through, these eat them. And so you put in these little isolated ponds, and any disease you get is also isolated. So that's got its advantage. And this has an advantage in that you can set these up in basically trophic ladders, in that you can grow shrimp in here and say smelt in here and rear eels in here, and it's a food flow down system. And that's quite ideal for something like eels. And you can, obviously, you can elaborate that system as much as you like. You can have high and low pH cycles coming through here. If you lime all these ponds and put something like those little scuds in, which you'll love, you know, those little amphipods, at high pH, you've got... these are just scud production. They're not eel. And that's when you come out on top with your eels, if you can afford to put in your food ponds in sequence so that your food is continually flowing into the eel ponds. And then these ponds are very, very commonly made, and they have two reasons. One is they're particularly suitable to a valley site, on side valleys, where you're taking from the upper part of your stream and feeding back to your stream. It limits the possibility of disasters and escapes to have ponds in series, in parallel. And it's often used because the configuration of the valley floor only allows you to do ponds in parallel. So it's extremely common through Europe to find almost all their fish ponds in parallel series down the valley floors. So there's all sorts of reason to choose your configurations to suit your operation. This would be pretty fatal probably for some systems. You'd have to watch it. I think for single species systems, these should all be sort of food, something like it, and only your terminal ponds as rearing ponds. Whereas these, you can put all sorts of year classes in here and control them. So, or you can do both. You can put some in parallel and some in series. Just have to consider your site, whether it suits series, whether it suits parallel. Have to consider your water flow, whether you can in fact sustain a set of parallel ponds, or whether you have to only a small flow. Now, configuration is a fascinating subject, and this is really our field, I guess. I want you to consider where a fish is drawing its sustenance from some zone of edge here, which is commonly the case. Trout feed mainly at the edge, so that you can stock a pond on two criteria. You can stock it on a square metre measurement of surface or a linear metre of edge. And you know, you can put about an inch per square metre of fish or an inch per linear metre of edge. So I'll do a pond here with a 5 metre radius, which gives us 75 metres squared. And we'll put a trout or a fish in, and there are numerous fish, grass carp, trout, shrimp even, depending on the production of vegetation at or near the edge, within a metre of the edge. And we'll do another pond of 75 square metres, and this one will be 75 metres long and 1 metre wide. Now, what's the measurement around here now, if it's 5 metre radius? 2 pi r, call pi 3. So it gives us what radius? 30 metres? And what's the perimeter of this one, 75 metres long and 1 metre wide? It's 152 metres. Therefore, your potential of feeding your animals or potential yield on this one as against that one, and is probably, you know, 5 times greater yield out of your long pond.
I sort of fairly good idea for that. There's a friend of mine who owns a cow and had on to this block, and he was a man keen swimming before he went out. So after he went out on the block, he was built a swimming pool that was just 1 lane wide, 15 wide. And it was dirt on the inside. So he was swimming.
This suits another thing. This, to make that pond on a steepish side, we have to flatten quite a lot of the side. Whereas the Swiss, who grow trout on very steep sides, really just do it as a series of descending channels. And in fact, we find they get yields, you know, 100 times greater than you would in the same area of large pond. And it's called channel culture. So these long ponds also suit rather impossible sites, because it's just a backhoe system. As long as you can get a hoe on, or even hand dig them in Switzerland, they run these long channels, and the trout are dependent on the edge, because an awful lot of trout food is insect food that has to cross the edge. And quite obviously, less of it crosses the edge of a 30-metre edge and does a 152-metre edge. And the other thing, a grass carp do infinitely better in channels than they do in ponds. So you've got to consider configuration of your pond. And then how wide is your edge? Well, the other thing about these things is, with adding a metre of anything like mesh, you can segment your pond, whereas it takes you quite a few metres of anything to segment these awkwardly large or awkwardly shaped ponds. So you can have this end of a pond, just for very cheaply, you can separate it out. You can have shrimp in here and eels in here or something. And it's quite hard to segment these ponds without a great reduction of edge. So there's all sorts of reasons for looking at your configurations. One of the properties I've visited has nothing but longitudinal contour ponds, just a whole series of them. It's fantastic. Very, very rich place. Even the birds seem to be a lot more birds, a lot more fish. Everything seems to buzz along. And probably the richest culture we know about is the Chinampa culture, which is the alternating water and earth system. And I think theoretically this is the most productive culture that we've ever evolved. Now, basically you could develop it in a swamp simply by scooping out successive channels and heaping your swamp peat up here, and then you grow on here and you grow in here. It was developed first by the Mexicans at Mexico City out of the swamp on which it stood, although it's got its exact equivalents really in Kashmir and Thailand. If you've been to Thailand, you see them all growing along here, don't you? And these are about 6-8 feet wide in Thailand, and so is the water. So it's quite an even harmonic. But you can imagine that you can actually stagger your harmonic too. Grow more in the water and less on the land, or more on the land and less in the water. So these are possible variations depending on how you define your product. The thing about these, as long as these are no higher than 1 metre, then you don't have to water them. So there's situations which are fully watered, self-watered, because water will soak up into those earth mounds. So they're extremely productive land systems. What the Mexicans grow in there isn't fish, it's axolotls. Axolotls. You know, those big mud puppies, eh? Or So they don't grow fish, they grow axolotls, because they're not bony like fish, they eat them. And so that's their main product out of the Chinampa. The Thais grow a variety of native fish that run in from the rivers. And then they're also excellent vine situations, because you can't beat waterside locations for vines. So throughout Kashmir, typically you get pond edge with vine crop all grown out over the water. It has about 6 good effects. Any insect predators of the vine that stumble fall in the water. Birds can't easily fly up and take the fruits because they don't have any hang-on point. And that space is not otherwise used. And you've got frost control over your water and a beneficial reflection. So all in all, most vines occur naturally as waterside plants. So if you set up your Chinampa or your harmonic right to be productive of vines, also because the other really good thing about it is that you have a very good transport system for heavy loads. It's the best way. Even in taro patches, nobody bothers to carry the taro out. You just tow a little boat on your belt, a little guy that you carry there, about that far across, and just put your taro in and tow it out. So, I mean, they're excellent transport systems too. So you can carry in big loads and carry big vines in pots in and carry lots of tonnages of stuff out without much effort at all. Like a 9-year-old girl with a paddle will bring out 3 tons of vine, typically. So it has lots of advantages. And this is a very productive and very complex potential system. So you want to think before you make your pond like that, you know, and see if it's not possible to make for the fish you're after, if it's edge dependent, or the product you're after, not to make it like that. That would be the case if you're looking at edge plants as part of your product, because say we're planting blueberries in a metre apart, we're going to get 30 blueberries around this pond and 152 blueberries around this pond. And there's a huge difference in product. And it just makes a difference on whether you're economical or not, but you're using exactly the same water surface area. Now consider a situation now, we've got a complex, we did it that way, in which your Chinampa also, in plans, varies, and you've probably hit about the ultimate system. So sort of Chinampa on contour would be probably about the ultimate possible production of landscape or landform. The Swiss make all their trout ponds like that. They just follow contour and then they drop the water and follow contour and drop the water and follow contour. And they're notoriously productive. And I guess they would leave about 3 times the earth between the pond width and the pond width. So you're often going along channels only 4 feet wide and there's 12 feet of slope and then another 4-foot channel. And a little stream comes in the top and drops from one to the other through pipes. And they are fantastically productive systems. So, and they're only growing trout, whereas they could also grow lots of blueberries along and all sorts of things just to the benefit of the trout, you know. So, I guess when you're thinking of configurations, you want to consider this. So, less feeding involved here by a long, long way, and more plant production on edge, where your plant is dependent on the edge or your animals depend on the edge. There may be other things which is a good reason to build your pond squarish. There's a very good reason to build a circular pond. And that is, if you're recycling water, you have limited water and you're putting your water, pumping it back, putting it through a filter and putting it back, and you're rearing trout, they have a pipe here with offset jets. It hits the top of the pond and creates a constant water circulation. And a circular pond is just the best configuration for that. And when your trout swim, they grow faster than if they stay still. So there they've got to move, and the food's kept circulating, and that's much the best configuration. Best for young trout, and for not much else, really. And this is best for all sorts of other things, shrimp, grass carp, practically most things, depending on edge feeding. Yes, we'll do orders of depth too. Again, you've got to define your end product or the sort of thing you're going to make a living out of. There's no reason not to have a set of orders of depth. For things like Chinese water chestnut and like taro, you need very little water, sort of 2 inches of water or something. And as that's extremely cheap to add, if you have an existing pond, it's very cheap to grade off a shelf only 2 inches deep around that pond. It's a fiddling amount of energy to put that in, or in the back of existing dams, all sorts of places. And then that means you've got quite a wide band of, and the same in here, you then move to wild rice, or you can move to lotus, and then you've still got a beaut fish pond with a fantastic edge. And you've got a shrimp area here which the fish can't utilise, because they can't get through the vegetation to these food animals, which themselves easily disperse at a constant rate into the ponds. So that's a very basic consideration. And this is where Swingle says half your pond can be inaccessible to the fish and you still will get more yield. You've still got highly oxygenated water because you've still got all the surface left, but now you've got a huge area of free breeding food. One of the important ones is that little scud, that little shrimp guy. He's only half an inch long. He's an amphipod, really, lots of little legs. You've all seen him, I'm sure. He's usually green and he just scoots along in real shallow water. Well, he breeds by the billions, providing he's not in a pond where the fish can get him, because they get all of him. So when a fish can get its food, he gets all its food. The same actually goes for smelt, that you can keep smelt in these ponds, little forage fish which breed in the shallows, and they form a major part of your fish food, but the smelt is always in high production, because they have their own area of the pond in which they can breed. Shrimp, scud, and if you can't do that physically, the alternative is to throw piles of brush into your pond where small fish and shrimp and scuds can escape the fish. So it's the principle of wildlife management. You can modify existing ponds simply by brushing up parts of them, making them inaccessible to the fish. Now, so those depth orders, and there's other reasons for depth, in that over at 15 feet here, you can get a cold reservoir which remains relatively cool in hot weather, and fish will kettle there, and you can get a warm reservoir there for frosting. So your fish have a withdrawal place. And for instance, when you're in cold areas, you almost automatically build a kettle just using a backhoe, just make a small kettle, 10 feet square or something, in the pond base, just so your fish survive the winter. Because they all go in there and they all sit quite still over the winter. They don't move much. They stop feeding and just kettle up where there's a bit of warm water. Of course, you get a temperature inversion in winter if you've got more than 5 metres depth. Water's warmer at the base than it is on top, where it may be frozen for a metre. So there's reasons for this order of depth. But generally speaking about fish ponds, 2 meters is about the depth that is most efficient for ponds. And that doesn't mean you make them 2 meters, it means you make them 1.5 to 3 metres on a sloping base, probably with a drain where you can drain your pond. If you need to drain your pond, and there's all sorts of reasons to drain your pond, including to utilise your phosphate briefly for a land crop. If you can drain a little pond, hop in there with melons in midsummer and use your phosphates, then sow it with clover and then re-flood it for winter and put your fish back in, you've got a really good crop system. So pond configuration and the orders of size and depth are quite specific. And again, these have a profound influence on your yield. These are great. Design of the pond is a large factor in yield. It's probably a factor of between 10 to 20 times that of just a simple, thoughtless kind of a construction. And the more you know about the fish you're growing, the better you can design your pond.
Bill, not in a big pond. What about drainage in situations where you don't have drainage, they're self-sustaining?
You can sometimes siphon them out if you need to drain them, or you can keep them on a constant trap restock system. But for really serious fish cultures, depend on how you're going to go at it. If you're going to make a living out of it, I would always make provision to drain the ponds.
Even that top
system? It depends on the order of size of it, right? If it's over 8 hectares, forget it. You're just on a harvest system. But below that, if all you can afford to do is build 4 quarter-hectare ponds, which would be pretty common for a small holder, then make sure each of them are drainable so you can fully restock and fully empty them. There's all sorts of excellent reasons. So you can lime them to remove any diseases that have occurred and put them through a dry land cycle. There's all sorts of excellent reasons to drain an intensive set of systems.
If you had a disease in a pond, would it be a way to actually drain it and put it through the dry land cycle to get rid of that disease?
That's how they do it, in effect. They drain it, lime it, and chop the lime into the base mud, put it through a couple of crops and then bring it back into fish production. And there's hardly any disease that survive that. There's one or two you can read about. But about 98% of fish diseases disappear over that dry cycle. Plus you get a total harvest, which is very rare in a managed pond. Right. So all of those are considerations towards pond design. Other than that, it's all practical earthworks. Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Configuration. Yeah, I think this is our field. You know, we say to somebody, what do you want to do? They say, we want to grow trout, right? So we set them up. So do you want to feed them or do you want to be largely self-fed? And then we set up either series, and then we set up little shallow ponds and shallows in the trout pond if they want to feed trout to feed themselves. And of course, I think you can read the breakdown of costs in fish rearing. Something near 60% of total costs is in the feeding of the fish, and an additional very large amount, 30%, is in, if you have to pump water, is an energy cost associated with the ponds. And if you can eliminate both of those, A, by site choice for your energy costs, and B, by providing a very large forage system for the particular fish, well then you're very, very competitive. You know, you're producing fish at 10% of the cost of the concrete pond, circular concrete pond guy.
Is it so, not very
labour-intensive? It need not be. It need not be. The other point about fish is they're subject to two sorts of predation. They're notoriously poached. It's very hard to resist a pond full of big rainbow trout if you've got a net. And they're very, very valuable, so they're very tempting to poachers, and that's true also of prawns. So there's lots of midnight amateur prawners walking through the Hawaiian prawn ponds. And the other thing is they're subject to natural predation by things like cormorants. So for intensive rearing of high value food, it's a very good idea to put your house right in the middle of the system and keep a little dog. You know, cormorants are easily dealt with though. Well, it's basically predation control.
How do you deal with cormorants?
You hang a shark net in there, 5-inch shark net, and that way the trout get to eat the cormorants. The trout come and go through a 5-inch mesh, unless a monster trout, but a cormorant can't fly through it underwater, and he turns into trout food.
Is there a problem with pollution from a dead cormorant?
No, not the occasional dead cormorant, no.
What about leaf fall into the pond? So you've got trees around this.
It can be pluses or minuses. If it's so heavy that your oxygen level drops, it becomes a minus. And then you've got to have a lot of... That's why you've got yabbies, shrimps and mussels in there, because they're decomposers. And they really are consuming that and building it into protein. It's not being consumed by bacterial action. If there's not enough of it, you're losing nutrient. So it's really a balanced situation. If there's too much of it, it's a resource. You can pump it out with a simple sludge pump and raise the level of your land crop with it. So it's really a management problem. But certainly you can get ponds that have too much leaf in and go anaerobic, and you can get ponds with too little leaf in where you haven't got enough biological turnover. So it's kind of an adjustment thing.